You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education Books podcast. I am absolutely delighted to have in the studio today Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, novelist, scholar, professor of philosophy at the New College of the Humanities in London, and a research associate in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University. But the reason I have her here today, the reason I've lured her into this small room with a microphone, is that her latest book, Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away, has attracted endless numbers of plaudits, not least from our reviewer who's made it a Book of the Week. Rebecca, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. What a pleasure to be here.
Well, this book is, to me, who worries as she gets older that she might not be able to learn new things, I have to say that selfishly part of me thought, this is Plato the inspiring senior citizen. He's 2,400 years old and he's still keen to learn. He goes to Google's headquarters, he learns about the web, he joins a public debate on child rearing, he talks to a shock jock, he has an fMRI scan, and this is all done in dialogues that are, I assume, a lot like Plato's dialogues, where we get some of the in-jokes just as Plato's audience would be. He's an inspiring guy, this Plato of yours.
Yeah, what I, you know, and Plato, of course, himself, the real man, is an inspiring guy. And I did try in creating these dialogues to, you know, I don't want to make up Plato whole cloth. I am tying it down to as much as I can to things he actually said. But I do think we've made an awful lot of progress in the 2,400 years since Plato designed philosophy and also in some sense contributed to what it would eventually become science. And so, you know, he certainly doesn't have all the answers, and he's keen to learn. There's a lot not to like in Plato, and when you spend as much time with him as I, you know, Karl Popper had famously accused him in The Open Society and Its Enemies as being public enemy number one, as being a totalitarian, a fascist, and there are aspects of that. I mean, he's framing these questions for the very first time, and his first approximation and answers are, we've learned better in the two millennia and a half since he proposed them. What I was trying to do with this, with my Plato, my redesigned Plato, was to distill what I think of as the best of the spirit of philosophy. So yes, insatiably curious about everything there is to know. So he gets himself a computer, a Chromebook at Google headquarters, and he's constantly Googling, and he's trying to learn all of the science and everything.
His eyes light up when someone mentions the cloud.
Exactly. Oh, what a Platonic idea that is, right? All this information up there, but not localized in any one place, but we can draw it down and access it. You know, so he wants to learn everything. He's very open. I think, you know, that is the best of the spirit of philosophy. This is not to say that all philosophers are so open, but that's the best of it. He tries to take in other points of view and, you know, see if he has something to learn from them, something to challenge his own point of view. And indeed, he does make progress in talking to us because we make progress since he roamed the earth. And he's somebody who's very playful. I think that's important. I think the real Plato was playful, that you see that in the dialogues. Playful and taking truth very seriously, but not himself very seriously. Again, this is, I think, the best of the spirit of philosophy, not always manifested in real living philosophers, but would that it were so. And somebody who is not unfamiliar with tragedy, you know, who understands that, you know, a human life is, there's a tragic, you know, element to it in our mortality, in our awareness of mortality, and how philosophy is done in the light of that, the more tragic vision. Of of the human condition. So all those things, which, you know, for me was meant that I would could turn him into a Plato that I could love, you know, and he becomes more lovable as he goes on.
It does feel so much like an act of love. Part of the reason that I found this book so much warmer and less terrifying than I might have been expecting, reading a book by an eminent philosopher such as yourself, is that your voice comes through as a kind of, listen, you've got to meet Plato. You'd love him. He does seem, I have to say, like the dream doctoral supervisor or just the ideal platonic version of what the best philosophy lecturer would be like. He dumps his misogyny. He's respectful to women. He stops talking about slaves because he knows it's not appropriate to do.
Yes.
He's other people are noting he's saying he or she instead of just he.
Yes. Yes.
I love the fact that you are so upfront. You say, my Plato is an impassioned mathematician, a wary poet, an exacting ethicist, a reluctant political theorist, a man keenly aware of the way that assumptions and biases slip into our viewpoints. I wonder, does it matter if this is actually Plato so much as a description of what we hope we could all be as scholars and thinkers and what academics could hope to be?
Yes, I think that's not really Plato.
Are you sure? look a bit young to know him, I'm just saying.
You know, there are these expository chapters that fill in between the dialogues in which, you know, Plato, you know, I try to connect and to present, you know, Plato as he probably really was, a citizen of ancient Athens, and put him in the context of what that was, to be a citizen of ancient Athens. And of course, every society has its prejudices, and certainly that one did as well. You know, it was a society that valued even ancient Athens, this democracy. You know, it was
a third of the population.
Exactly. You know, perhaps there were 300,000 people living there, according to some of the best estimates. At most, 100,000 were citizens. There were slaves, there were women, there were foreign residents who could not participate in the democracy. And, you know, and their word for all non-Greeks was barbarians, because, you know, to Greek ears, non-Greek languages were so much
bar, 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 bar,
bar, bar, ancient Greek for, this is the word, the ancient Greek we all know, bar, 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 means blah, blah, blah. And you know, he would have his, you know, his mind kind of blown by how far we've come, long way to go, but that was partly my point, that this process of self-critical reason has taken us far. So if we bring back one of the people who was most responsible for this methodology of of reasoning our way towards understanding ourselves in the largest context possible, which is what I think philosophy is, if we bring him back, he's going to be blown away. You know, he himself was so committed to the belief that philosophy can make progress. So in some sense, if Plato had all the answers, he couldn't have all the answers, because one of his answers is that philosophy makes progress. So therefore, he would have to have been, you know, incomplete or wrong about many things. So, I mean, there's no way, in fact, that he could have known everything. And I wouldn't want to claim that. You know, there are people who claim it. And I did depend very much on Plato scholars. I'm not a Plato scholar, and but I did, you know, consult many of them, and a few of them were a little, chagrined at my claim that he didn't have all the answers, because some of them really believe
yes,
he does. And I met an Aristotelian over the weekend. I was at the Battle of Ideas here in London, and I met somebody who was just, he rejected all of modern science because Aristotle had all the answers.
Of course, the student overtakes the teacher.
but you know, he said to me, "You don't believe in Einstein's theory, do you?" This man said, "You know, because you know this upstart Einstein who wants to topple Aristotle." I do not think that that's what these ancients had in mind. They started a process, and I think they believed in the process. And Plato himself, I believe, took back many of the doctrines that he tries out in various dialogues, and he uses, what a thing he did. He used the dialogue form. He didn't write a treatise. He wasn't, sort of handing down from on high, this is the truth. He puts these various positions that he tries out and that are questioned in the context of the dialogue, he puts them into, characters' mouths.
Let's see how they work.
Let's see how it works. And then if there's any doctrine that we associate with Plato, it's the theory of forms. And in the Parmenides, he has a very young Socrates. He regresses Socrates, not the old wise man, but this young man speaking to the metaphysician Parmenides, who is presenting trenchant criticisms of the theory of forms, which young Socrates can't answer. And then the theory of forms really disappears, I would say, from the later dialogues. I think Plato rethought it. It's in the later dialogues, it's mathematics. That's the key to the intelligibility of the universe, an idea that had an absolutely revolutionary effect on a person named Galileo in the 17th century, who sort of took fire from that and always referred to Plato as the divine Plato, because that Timaeus had really given him the key that it would be beautiful mathematics that would be the give us insight into the nature of physical reality. But Plato himself is taking things back and questioning himself. And that's, and so I think I wasn't, although I wanted to really emphasize that in my Plato, my new and improved Plato, my character of Plato, I think there's real grounds in the real Plato. You can find it in the Platonic dialogues, this self-questioning, opening, let's do philosophy by bringing many points of view together. And in the clash of points of view, we have to defend ourselves. We have to lay out our reasons, and maybe we'll be convinced by the other. That's the best of philosophy.
Your Plato seems to make the case that the reflective life, questioning things, considering things, allows you to be adaptable. That you can face the future or the unknown future. We talk about higher education as a way of preparing young people for the future, for jobs that may not yet exist, and that a good liberal arts education or science education, broad-based education, will allow you to do a job that you're not being trained for specifically, that it's not instrumentalist. It seems to me that if you womp a philosopher down 2,400 years later, he does, of course, you've helped him along, but he's done a pretty good job of coping with things. And I guess that's what we would hope that the training of the intellectual person would allow us to do as we move into the future, maybe just when we're 80 or 90, not 2,400 years old.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, flexibility of mind, being able to defend your point of view means that you have to take seriously the possibility that it's not right. I mean, you're offering defenses in the light of possible attacks. You have to be thinking about that all the time. How could somebody attack my point of view? And that means that you're entertaining the possibility in the very defense of your, if you're doing it right, the very defense of your point of view, that you may not be right. And this, would one hope give one a certain flexibility, entertaining the possibility of being false, and entertaining the possibility of changing your point of view, changing your mind about things. We're so afraid to change our minds. It's actually, it's a wonderful experience. I changed my mind quite a lot. I was brought up in a very religious household. I was very, I would say a fundamentalist. I was brought up in a fundamentalist household. And I was, when I was a true believer. And I've changed my mind about that. And there is, when you consider various, and I'm so glad that I, And I'm not glad that I changed my mind about that. I guess I am, but even if I had come to the conclusion that it was right, the process of coming to that conclusion, not just accepting it, I believe in this really strongly. I think it's part of our human responsibility we believe and we feel our beliefs are justified and we act on our beliefs, you know, so our actions themselves are determined, often by our beliefs. And so it is, and this is such a Platonic idea, that it is, you know, our responsibility to take these very, very seriously and to be able to defend them. And to defend them means to consider the possibility that they're false. What would we say to somebody who disagrees with us? And a kind of flexibility, a kind of being able to imagine your way into a different way of seeing the world entirely has got to go along with that. And that's the ultimate kind of flexibility. And that I also think can be, you know, has real applicability, real applications in helping us to face the future.
It seems like a very stirring speaking up for this radical view of human agency that I can change. Obviously, there are many kinds of scholarship that focus on the extent to which people's views were defined by the times they lived in.
Yeah.
Well, Plato lived in a time where there were slaves, and
yes,
he might have thought about that, but he couldn't look beyond that. And some people lived in a time where, by and large, most people thought slavery was okay, or women shouldn't have the vote, or that the earth was flat. And, it's very important for us not to judge other times by our standards or other cultures. And I think it's an important part of education. But to also be able to say, yes, but you are not just a victim of your class or your race or your period in history is a really exciting thing to say.
Yeah, no, I think it is. And if we, you know, actually look at the people that we celebrate and honor rightly as moral revolutionaries who took us to the next place, you know, it was they were at odds with their society. I mean, starting with Socrates, he was at odds with his society. He was condemned by the great Athenian democracy to death for questioning their values, and he was brought up on the charges of impiety and corrupting the young, and convicted, was, you know, given the hemlock. There was Socrates and Spinoza excommunicated by his Jewish community of Amsterdam, and then condemned by greater Christian Europe, you know, as the great heretic, somebody who tried to found morality on purely secular grounds, as he tries to do in the Ethics, and brought us a lot further, seeded the Enlightenment. You know, these are people who were out of sync with their times. Erasmus, who also, you know, argued against his society, but the first person to argue that there are certain things that we ought not to do in war. A new idea, a revolutionary idea. You know, the first people who made the arguments against slavery. These are all, they're out of sync with their society, and they're, so it's, you know, they're, but they're making an argument and saying, you know, we've already have certain moral commitments. There are consequences of those commitments. There are entailments. Because of our own self-interest, we are hiding from our inner moral incoherence. Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, all of the people that we celebrate as moral heroes, as opening our eyes, were not consulting their society. They were, you know, fierce critics of their society. I'm trying to remember the name of... Or I would like to put a woman in here, but Eleanor Roosevelt, arguing so hard for the Declaration of the Universal Rights, of Universal Human Rights. This was a radical idea, and the woman worked so hard to get that passed by the UN, that there are fundamental human rights that just go along with the description of somebody as a human being. It has taken us so long to argue, to see that. It was all people who were out of sync with their society who have brought us to this level. And, you know, and we still have a ways to go. No, never smug, never thinking, well, we've arrived now.
We're there.
I'm firmly convinced that, you know, our grandchildren will look back at us and say, what? How could they
that
not have seen? How could they not have seen? And it's one of my, you know, favorite games of my husband and me to play is, what will our, if we ever have grandchildren or great-grandchildren, what will they look back and say, how could these people have abided that?
And not questioned it.
And
where were those voices? And of course...
Exactly.
It seems to me that I guess the other big point of the book, and I suppose that no book by a philosopher cannot at least be in part about this, that it asks the question, what is a philosopher? Is it a moral exemplar, Socrates,
yes,
or is it a specific kind of researcher learning about particular stuff, just like chemists are or psychologists? Or is a philosopher a catalyst or a trainer for intellectual growth, or is he or she the person who plants those seeds of social breakthrough, those little depth charges? So, or sometimes I wonder, reading the dialogues in your book and elsewhere, is philosophy like watching an intellectual tennis match? And I don't mean that in a dismissive way. It's like seeing two incredibly talented players. I have to confess that, you know, when I meet Cheryl, the book publicist, and Marcus, the software engineer, and the characterizations are so vivid and playful and funny, and I think at first, okay, she'll be shallow, he'll be a geek, oh yes, they'll be kind of little puppets doing silly things. And then I find myself saying, good point, Cheryl. Oh, well done, Marcus. And really enjoying it. And is it wrong of me to sit there slightly open-mouthed and say, well, I can see the strengths of each?
Well, no, absolutely. I'm so glad to hear you say that. It's so easy to knock down straw men or women, straw persons. you've got to you know, present these arguments as viable, and I think that these people who you might think a philosopher would dismiss, you know, have to be taken very seriously. And my Plato learns from them. Cheryl, you know, she gives him what for, you know, and he in turn, you know, kind of explodes her mind. He makes her more questioning. You know, she, I think all of my, the other characters, the foils for Plato, become a little deeper in the presence of Plato, but they have a lot to teach Plato as well. And Plato, being, you know, my ideal of a philosopher, is open to learning from them. And as you say, he learns from them.
They're very humane presentations. It's so easy to imagine that their characters, the stern Viennese psychoanalyst Dr. Munitz and Sophie Z, who's a sort of Amy Chua tiger mother type or a broad caricature, even, since I'm a person who interviews people, Zach Burns, I think, oh, the hearty interviewer who sometimes asks slightly dim questions, or, you know, the shock jock Roy McCoy, or David Shokit, who I assume, you know, a play on his name, like the ritual slaughterer.
Oh,
that
very
seems
good.
Like,
yes.
Like a good Hebrew joke
very
lying
good.
There.
Yes.
All of these people are not idiots and not puppets, and I was very surprised.
Oh, yeah, no.
You treat them with such humanity and respect and kindness. You show their flaws, but Plato doesn't just come in and go, you're an idiot, you're a different kind of idiot, you're a third kind of idiot.
No, exactly right. And, you know, Plato, you know, I one of the things that I wanted to bring him back here to learn, and I think it's, you know, one of the ways in which we've made progress since Plato is, you know, he didn't have a great deal of respect for the masses of people, to say the least, right? And, you know, he wants a philosopher king, and then there'll be the guardians who, you know, who know how to think, and who will, you know, who have innate talent, and then will be subjected to a rigorous training so that they'll learn how to think. And the rest, you know, well, there'll be the warriors who are, you know, athletically.
With their silver souls.
Silver soul. But yeah, I mean, talk about a genetic determinist, right? That noble lie. There are the golden souls and the silver and the, you know, the bronze and iron, the masses of people who will keep the state going, you know, be the craftspeople and the farmers. But we'll have no part really, and it's against democracy. How can you trust the masses of people to vote? They could be so easily swayed by demagogues, and you know, and indeed, it is human nature is weak. That's why we do need education, and our educators should be trying to not only teach their specific subjects, but trying to form good citizens of our society who know how to think and who won't be swayed by demagogues or confuse entertainment with politics and all the things that Plato actually warned us about. And that the founders, forgetting where I was, right? But the founders, in America, were very aware. They were all classically trained, and they had read their Plato, and they were wary of democracy, and a lot of the safeguards that they put into the Constitution, including the Electoral College, were because they themselves had imbibed some of Plato's mistrust of the unwashed masses. But
so it's a complex legacy.
But if I wanted to bring my Plato back here and say, you know, we're doing a pretty good job. We're all of these various people who are not, including the escort, his media escort, who doesn't know anything about philosophy, but she's got something to teach Plato there, and that we all care about these problems very much. I think that's one of the things we're all interested in, whether we realize it or not, in the problems of philosophy. We've all got views about what the right way of living is, and you know, how to justify our actions and our beliefs. So if philosophy is the subject that pays attention to this, then philosophy is for everybody, and it's incumbent on philosophers to make it available to everybody.
And you have Plato learn and make this radical statement of the individual mattering to the individual, and that
exactly.
value at the very end to Dr. Shokit, when he says, well, you know, I'd like to see a scan of my brain. This is when he goes into the magnet, the fMRI scanner, and speaks to a neuroscientist who's got very defined ideas about thought merely being some pixels that will get on the screen later. We don't have them just yet. And he says he would like to see his own brain, and there's just a lovely conclusion to the book. This neuroscientist, who we think of as a bit of a jerk, who perhaps treats Plato, his research subject, in the same way that maybe Plato might have looked at the great masses of people.
Uh-huh.
They're just there to make up the numbers.
Yeah.
And Plato says, I cannot say why one's own brain should matter so much to one just because it happens to be one's own, but it does. It undeniably does. You have a lovely dialogue there, and then at the very end, the book ends with the... I hope I'm not giving anything away.
Oh, no, it's not a novel.
It ends with a very moving moment where Agatha, the grad student, says, you know, I know we've said that he can't look at his own brain because there might be a tumor there and then he'd sue us, but do you think we could give Plato what he's asked of us? He's waited such a long time. And Dr. Shokit, horrible egotistical sciences. Of course we can. Of course we will.
Yeah, I. You know that really that broke me.
It was
off.
So moving.
It really did.
I got a little teary reading.
Well, oh, I'm so glad to hear that because, you know, I mean, I also write novels, and this is, all of this is my attempt to show how deeply involved we all are on the issues of philosophy, you know. So I've tried to write novels, you know, these philosophical novels, and then this is yet another experiment trying to make this case that, you know, we're also very deeply involved in these questions, engaged in these questions.
We care about our lives.
They are about our lives. What matters? What could possibly matter more to us? And about, you know, not squandering this one life that we have by doing, you know, foolish or even bad things. You know, but how bad is that? You know, and as Socrates warned in the very beginning, the worst thing that one can do for oneself is to be you know, an evil person. That is what a squandering of a human life that is. Because every life does matter in some norm, you know, in some meta ethical way, in some ethical way. Every life is, it matters, and if I'm going to maintain that my life matters, and who doesn't, right? Who doesn't live their life maintaining, you know, acting, planning for their future, being devastated when things go wrong, happy when they go right, you know, deeply involved in living a human life, and feeling that it matters, and knowing when it's wrong, when other people don't treat them with mattering. If we're going to do that, what else is entailed? How far else do we have to take this? Can there be private mattering? Or do we have to keep taking it farther and farther, including, you know, I should say, you know, to the generations to come that we tend to discount? We tend not to worry too much about our actions affecting, you know, the generations to come. So this sort of... So you had, a while back, we've gone so far in our conversation, but you asked me what I think a philosopher is, and that's an, you know, that's an interesting question. That itself is a philosophical question. What is a philosopher? And there's been a lot of arguments, even within the academy, and now often coming from scientists, that philosophy is obsolete. That science has taken over the questions that philosophy
that it was first cold
proposed.
Storage, as you say, a that metaphor
storage.
Of it being, we've got an idea of something we want to find out, but we're still living in mud huts, so we'll call it a philosophical idea
exactly.
until the 21st century can come along.
Exactly.
And sort
so,
it out.
Yes, and so my, you know, Dr. Shokat is a, you know, is very much a spokesperson for this point of view, where we're now going into the brain. We know what's going on in that brain. So, all of the questions that haven't already been answered by cosmology and physics, you know, the nature of the physical universe, now cognitive neuroscience is going to answer. And just as science progresses, it swallows up more and more philosophical territory. So you are obsolete or soon to be obsolete and get out of the academy, which is, you know, it's an interesting thing because, of course, the first field in the academy was philosophy, since Plato founded the academy.
And Karl Popper is responsible for the doctrine of falsifiability that scientists use to prove what science is.
Exactly.
They don't like to give him props very often, especially since they're so dismissive sometimes, some scientists of philosophy of science.
Exactly.
They
need philosophy of science to even be able to make the case that to demarcate between what science is and what other things are, and also to argue that science is describing reality. That's a philosophical position. There are other positions on you know, the scientific theories are just instruments for making predictions. It's not really discovering the ontological furniture, you know. It's not that we're discovering that there are, you know, elementary particles or strings or the structure of space-time or that there are neurons. This is just ways of ground. Or there's the view recently put forth in Stephen Hawking's new book, wonderful book, of course, but there's a philosophical view. He dismisses philosophy of science there, too, and puts forth a philosophical view about what science is. It's a kind of construction in our minds. It's really, you know, it is dependent on, it's mind dependent. These it's not an objective description. Not a real argument there. It's a possible view. It has a long history. It has connections to what Kant had said. But he doesn't. it doesn't even rise to the level of philosophy because he doesn't argue it there. He just puts it forth. It's not entailed by the science itself, what it is that scientists are doing. We can agree on the science and disagree on what it is that science is doing. I just mentioned, you know, three possible views of it, a sort of Kantian constructivism, instrumentalism, where it's just our ontology doesn't extend beyond experiences, and a scientific realism. No, we're discovering what really exists objectively out there. Three entirely different views. So what is philosophy? What I would say, my bumper sticker answer to what philosophy is that we're trying to maximize coherence. We're trying to take into account all of the knowledge we have presently, all the scientific knowledge included. That's why Plato is so, you know, greedy for for everything that science is presently telling us. You know, it's always under the condition of falsifiability. It may just be an approximation of the truth. It may be overturned. But what are we learning, saying right now about the nature of reality because of science? But bringing, that's not the whole story, because there are other intuitions that we have and that we need in order to live coherent lives, some of them ethical intuitions, certainly about our own selves, right? And that which emerged very early. Children are already saying, it's not fair, right? It's not fair. Yeah. She got more than me. You know, it's there. We come equipped with certain normative propositions, a sense of our own agency, that we are living our lives, that we are making decisions, that we have intentions. How many of these intuitions that we make use of in order to live coherent lives can be reconciled with science? Some of them may have to be given up, but it's that kind of mediation between science, other intuitions, sounding the implications of some of the intuitions that we have, what else follows. We're so compartmentalized. We live with so many contradictions, some of them very heinous, that the reasons for them is to act in our own self-interest and ignore the consequences of some of our moral intuitions, not apply them to other people. We make very slow progress in that regard. Just to go after the greatest amount of coherence possible, to make us as maximally consistent as possible, for our viewpoints, our view of the world, of us in the world, to be as defensible as possible. That's a very tall order, and I think that's what philosophy is really after. Big picture. How does it all hang together? How, you know, get our bearings in this world? Which we're all trying to do. We're all trying to get our bearings in this world.
When you talk about a certain kind of scientist who says, at best, like Whitehead said, all philosophy is footnotes to Plato, which is a massive diss.
Yes.
Yes. Stephen Weinberg, you know, his idea of cold storage, as you describe it. The philosophy jurors that you talk about.
Yes.
Lawrence Krauss, who is also at New College of the Humanities.
Yes. Fortunately, these people don't read me, so they don't know. Because I'm just a philosopher.
There was a glamorous woman in the hallway. Who knew she was a philosopher? She looked so intelligent. So, how widespread is this really? I mean, I understand that as a philosopher, you get your teeth into something and say, let's unpick it. Even if there's only two scientists say this, it's important to say why they're wrong.
Yeah.
Philosophers are never ones to give up a good argument just because of the pleasure of doing it. But is it really a widespread problem? Are philosophers made fun of at universities? Do chemists point at them? Do they say, put them with the kids? I mean, or really, I just assume that all academics, unless you're teaching homeopathy, academics tend to respect each other. Is it a problem?
I think philosophy has a particular problem. I think one of the clues to why it has a particular problem comes from Plato in his dialogue with Protagoras. But yes, I I've been very surprised to find, like, even in psychology, one might say softer one of the worst things you can say about something is you know, that it's philosophical. Some point of view is philosophical.
Short form for bullshit.
Bullshit, exactly. You know, based on nothing. Fringy.
Airy fairy.
Yeah, airy. Okay, so last night I was at the gave a talk at the British Humanist Association at the BHA. And they were a wonderful crowd because they were a tough crowd, very, very skeptical, and mostly scientists who were there. And one of the first questions I got, because I had toyed very much when I was an undergraduate, I studied a lot of physics, and I had thought I might go on in physics, long, complicated story, not of much interest to anybody but me. Decided to go into philosophy, but somebody, a prominent person, can I say his name? I don't know.
Sure, why
Peter,
not?
Peter Atkins, mm-hmm. Said
chemist.
Yes, mm-hmm. And he used that word airy fairy. Well, why did you leave physics discovers what is. This is airy fairy stuff, and I said, "Now, dear Peter, to defend your view that physics tells us what is, you need a philosophical argument. We are joined at the hip, philosophy and science. You know, for you to give your scientific triumphalist story, you are depending on a lot of hard philosophical work that you're not prepared to do. There's a division of labor. You know, you are prepared, even within science, you know, there's a real division of labor. There are observers, there are experimenters, there are theorizers, there are people who hate mathematics, there are people who are basically doing mathematics. Even within the science, there's a division of labor. There's a, you know, philosophers have their labor, and they are trained at entertaining many positions, and how do you defend this one, and how do you know to holding many positions, and not thinking anything is intuitively obvious. In fact, I think the progress of philosophy is digging out more and more presuppositions that went unquestioned. That were just part of the fabric of thinking, the structure of thinking. We just didn't notice them because we thought with them. And then digging those out and questioning them and sometimes overturning them.
Pulling them out by the roots in the same way that a scientist would agree, well, you weren't going to make much progress in physics when you believed that phlogiston was an important part of the world.
Exactly right, exactly. Or even, you know, more egregiously believed, you know, in Aristotelian teleology, thinking that, that all things move because they're trying to get to their rightful place. That flames leap because fire belongs up there, and rocks fall because made of earth out down there. Didn't get too far.
It was a good stab at things.
It was great. But it just didn't get us very far. And actually, it was that hint in Plato in the Timaeus that made the Copernicus and Kepler, Galileo think, it's mathematics, beautiful mathematics, that's the key. Let's apply that to experience. And then something that none of the Greeks, not even Aristotle, had, the notion of experiment, you know, and let's try to probe reality to answer us back when we're getting it wrong. I mean, that's basically what falsifiability is and what the experiment is. You know, so you think that simultaneity is absolute. It's intuitively obvious. How could you possibly doubt that? Well, you know, Einstein had, the smarts to say, no, might be false. And let's ask reality. Let's design an experiment so reality can answer us back. Einstein was thought of himself as a philosopher, and he read philosophy. He loved Spinoza, for example. He always described himself as a Spinozist. He was deeply familiar with the traditions in philosophy. He was very influenced by Ernst Mach, a philosopher, and that was partly how he devised his experiment, trying to to test whether or not simultaneity is absolute, and or his theory rather, but so this is a sort of, you know, the scientists who are saying that we can do away with this. It's not a coherent point of view. It's just not coherent because you can't make it without relying on philosophy. So why not either leave it to the philosophers, you know, who that's what they're trained to do. That's their expertise. Let them provide the arguments for you in your views about what science is doing, because they've thought about it and they've worked out the various possibilities. They know how to defend the various positions. Or else, even better yet, educate yourself in philosophy the way Einstein did.
Well, on the subject of education, before you came in, I walked around the office and asked a question of my colleagues. Now, some of the laudatory reviews of this book in the US press have said, in a kind of fond way, dust off that college Plato and go back to it. And, of course, there is a certain kind of reader in the United States, and I think of that, you know, the tradition of self-improvement, even if, you know, the autodidact, or if you've gone to college, or whether you have or not, that hunger amongst people who, you know, have some leisure time and a bit of comfort to learn more. There are all kinds of fantastic DVDs of great lectures, people taking MOOCs and so on who are retired. But the idea that you would have read Plato in college is maybe more of an American phenomenon than a British phenomenon. So I walked around. I was educated in Canada. I took a liberal arts sort of degree. I walked around and asked all my colleagues who had read Plato at university. The chap with a philosophy degree had.
Yes.
And the chap who studied politics had. But aside from my American colleague, no one else had. Now, obviously, there's a difference between the UK and the US system, and there are many other higher education systems in the world. But if you don't do civics, if you don't do Western Classics 101 along with freshman comp, would you say you're much more likely, as an eminent chemist from Oxford, to think philosophy is rubbish?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, part of the great argument for a liberal arts education, that I do think that philosophy is particularly important, I have to say. I mean, literature is very, very important. All of these, you know, and science and math, a well-rounded education is very, very important. But since, you know, we all are philosophers, we are, you know, when I was going to one of my events and here in London, and it was actually, you know, it was at a theater, and the cab driver said, "Oh, what are you going to go see?" And I said, "Oh, actually, I'm going to talk." And he said, "What are you going to talk about?" I said, "Philosophy." And he said, and he was right to say it, he said that he was a philosopher, and he had read various popular books of Alain de Botton, and, you know, somebody who I know people, you know, there are different views about what he's doing, but Alain de Botton, but he recognizes that these are issues that we all care about.
And there's a hunger amongst
people. There's a hunger.
People.
Because these are the biggest issues about, you know, what is it to live a good life? You know, what is it? What kind of life, you know, those of us who are responsible for younger people, either we're student, there are students, our children, whatever they, you know, our nieces, nephews, whatever, you know, what is it, what kind of values should we be giving them, you know, because we want them to live the best life possible. Should we be priming them for success, you know, should we be
training them for that exact job they're going to do?
Exactly right. Is that, you know, or is it knowledge for knowledge's sake, or is it, you know, happiness, however they find it, or is it, you know, being a good person, caring tremendously about justice and working for justice? What do we want from our children? And, you know, there's a tremendous obsession, at least in the States, of, you know, maybe because you know, we're having fewer and fewer children, but that, you know, these children are so, such a focus of attention and all the extracurricular
the stuff. The Sophie Z approach.
Yes, the Sophie Z, you know, and we got to make sure they're going to be successes and have the most, you know, the most options possible and live the good life. But what is the good life? And that is, you know, how can we not be, how all of us, you know, concerned with these questions? And there's a whole tradition and a discipline of thinking about that, laying out the various possibilities and making cases for them. And we shouldn't just accept our society's answers to these questions. I mean, I think it particularly hits us right now because people are looking at, even if they are religious, you know, they believe in God, and that's an important part of their view of the nature of reality, that it is a God-created and reality, and perhaps, you know, a God who's looking on, concerned for human welfare. But there is less a dependence on the answers of religion just to tell us what it is to live the good life.
So it's not purely normative delivery package of what to do.
Exactly. You know, that there is, you know, and in some sense, you know, there is a more, a rise of what, you know, of secularism in the Western world. I don't deplore it. I rather applaud it. And, but it means, you know, that those kinds of answers, you know, that were sort of handed down on what it is to live the good life, aren't as readily available to us for better or for worse. And other things are taking its place, you know, a kind of rampant consumerism, and also a kind of, I would say, you know, narcissism, you know, me. I want to be famous. I want a lot of attention.
The modern day arete.
Exactly. Right. The modern day, you know, kleos, you know, that was a very Greek idea, yes. You know, that's attention. And, you know, we have the social media that can give it to us. And it's a kind of, it's sort of interesting because it's exactly the kinds of answers that Socrates was objecting to in his own society that forced the field of philosophy to try to provide better answers. So I think it's a particularly, I mean, they were pre-monotheistic and we are, you know,
in many ways
we are increasingly post monotheistic, especially in terms, and they were a religious society, you know, they had
the social element, the rituals,
exactly,
the
trappings, you know, but when it came to these deep existential questions that concern all of us, here I am with this one life, you know, how do I make it a life that matters? It matters to me tremendously. How do I, you know, am I living it the way I ought to? That those questions, the Greeks didn't look to their gods for those. They were for their answers, unlike the Hebrews across the Mediterranean from them. But to each other, and it was really, you know, how much glory can I have? A way of trying to defeat the death that awaits us all is to just, you know, get as much attention as possible right now and to feel your life acquire a kind of moreness because of that. And it's interesting that we also, our society is increasingly giving that kind of answer. I think it's a real need for, and here's a field that emerged at exactly that point, you know, that kind of answer was being given.
On certain times.
In a certain, yes.
A decaying empire,
Exactly. And the Athenians feeling quite bad about themselves because they so prided themselves on being Athenians, the most extraordinary Greek city-state amongst the most extraordinary people, the Greeks, right? And they had been defeated by the Spartans and humiliated by the Spartans during that Peloponnesian War, a real case of collective hubris that had brought this defeat on themselves. And it was under those conditions that they charged Socrates, who was saying, charged Socrates with these crimes, with these capital crimes of impiety and corrupting the young, because he all along had been saying, just because you're Athenians, that you can't participate in living a worthwhile life in this, you know, in this kind of societal way. No, this is something for each person to do for himself or herself. It's not being reflected in other points of view. It's your own point of view. Make it a knowledgeable point of view. Make it a just point of view. That's the way to live a worthwhile life. So it's just so interesting. I see so many correlations between our time and ancient Greek time. And that was another motivation here. Let me bring Plato forward, because we need that kind of broad thinking to fill the normative vacuum that seems to have been left with the decline of theism, to be filled up with shallowness, with silliness.
But isn't that as subversive an idea now as it was in Socrates' time? To have someone who is constantly questioning things and willing to die. I mean, we know the expression willing to die for his beliefs, and of course that can be attached to all manner of things, suicide bombing and so on, or the great myth of dying for your country. Mm-hmm. But the fact that we still don't know, you know, we can't really get to what it was that, you know, Dr. Shokat talks about. Well, maybe, you know, people said he was doing it because he didn't want to, you know, get any older, or so, you know, he's theorizing about it. Is it not still deeply radical and subversive to teach people to think? Is what you are doing as an academic destabilizing the polis?
Well, there is that aspect, but there's also the fact that we in fact do live in a democracy. We are saying that the average citizen is capable of making these big decisions of how our polis ought to go. These are normative questions. So if we're going to live in a democracy and going to empower the citizenry to make these decisions, then they are so extremely complicated, these decisions, then we're going to have to take very, very seriously the powers of each of us to think and to think well, and to not just fill our minds up with silly, silly distractions.
So what gives you hope as an academic, as a teacher, an educator, as a scholar?
I am hopeful. I mean, when I it's always so interesting to me when I say that I don't usually say I'm a philosopher, you know, but I'll say I study philosophy, I teach philosophy, something of that sort, and people light up, you know, and they want to talk philosophy with me, and that gives me, you know, tremendous hope. And I mean, students give me hope. What makes me despair are the students who come in, you know, already knowing that they want, you know, what they want to do, and it's not particularly to be well educated. It is this notion of success, of being
credentialized.
Yes, to being a person with status, with power, with money, you know, that sort of thing. And they sort of come in already knowing what they want to get out of education. And it's too late. We've gotten to them too late. Maybe we've got to get into earlier. And because children are natural philosophers. They are, because they have that kind of flexibility. You know, it's all they're trying out all different conceptual schemes.
The playfulness
and the, you know, the amazing things that they come out and say. And as I say, they're already children at 3 years old. They're already occupying normative grounds when they know what's, when their rights are being violated. They know that very, very well, and so you can go quite far with them, and that's how we actually do teach them. Well, morality, you know, how would you feel if that was done to you? And they are able to do this. They can perform this experiment. I have much more faith in human nature than Plato did. I think, you know, that the progress that we've made is a testament to it. It's fragile. It can be overturned. You know, we saw that in Europe between 1939 and 1945, how all of these, the progress and our Enlightenment values can be completely overturned under certain conditions. So it's very, it's fragile. And, you know, the work, all, we can never take it for granted. It always has to be in the process. We always have to, let's not take our that Enlightenment for granted. All be overturned. That is the terrible, terrible message of the mid-20th century. There are ways of strengthening. That's really what education is about. And really, I would very much like our celebrity scientists, and I'm so happy they exist, because science is very important and their work is important, and it's important for their expertise to be shared by the citizens at large in making the decisions about things like global warming. That is, you know, we need them to be telling us. That is their expertise. So we have to recognize their expertise and in their area of expertise. But when they start talking about things outside their discipline, outside their expertise, I wish they would stop. And I really wish that these celebrity scientists would stop dissing philosophy. We need it now. We need it now more than ever. And they need it too.
Rebecca, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.